My other really good friend and I ran a crypto hedge fund. I think at peak, we managed $15 million in assets. We had a little bit of a lawsuit. Getting a subpoena while you're on your OB-GYN med student rotation is not fun. I was able to take advantage of the situation by buying 4 properties in cash from this couple, so the price was reasonable. I had one of them burned down my intern year. Don't be stupid. Get the insurance, pay the price. It is what it is. Medicine is amazing. It's a job I enjoy doing, even if you take away the money. Play a stupid game, win a stupid prize. Well, I can do that because I have something stable on the other side.
Welcome to Your Future Insight, a podcast where we showcase stories featuring doctors and other healthcare professionals early in their careers.
We'll take a deep dive into their day-to-day lives, focusing on how they navigate the current landscape of medicine. Each story is personal, captivating, and uniquely crafted by their individual perspectives and experiences.
In each episode, we'll discuss their challenges and aspirations, and most importantly, their journey, to give us insight into the future of medicine.
My name is Andres Parra.
And I'm Gio Campagna.
And we are your bro hosts, two friends turned ophthalmologists who enjoy learning from our peers. Let's get started. In today's episode, we will be speaking with Sagar Rambia. Sagar is a former cryptocurrency fund manager and entrepreneur who decided to pursue a career in medicine and is currently an ophthalmology resident at UCLA, where he is a PGY4. He is here today to share his unique personal experience with purchasing real estate as a trainee, being a landlord, and even flipping houses during residency, along with some other fascinating entrepreneurial pursuits. Depending on your own personal financial situation and the cost of living where you train, becoming a homeowner might be feasible, but the more common reality is that it remains a pipe dream for most. We're excited to learn more about how Sagar balances being a busy ophthalmology resident with his entrepreneurial pursuits. Stay tuned.
Okay, good morning, Sagar. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You know, you are such an interesting guy. You've got all these really eclectic interests, and I was hoping you could kind of start by telling us just a little bit about how you got interested in medicine and why ophthalmology, and then we'll jump into the meat of the topics, which is really about your real estate ventures. So share with us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I went into, you know, medicine and ophthalmology. Part of it's the stability, part of it's the, you know, being able to help people, part of it's the intellectual stimulation of your brain, part of it's being able to work with your hands. And then, you know, ophthalmology is one of the few fields, I think, in medicine where you can truly still run a private practice, which is something that really excited me.
Was there a specific age or time when you were like, man, this is really the time that medicine kind of struck out to you as something you wanted to do? Or is that something that progressively built over time? What was there? Was there a turning point or just a general feel?
Yeah, I think it was watching my dad, who's a solo practice oncologist in Brooklyn, kind of do, you know, the grind, obviously, of medicine. But the other side of it's like, you know, you have patients that really rely on you. They would like save in parking spots in the morning and you know, always like treat me really nicely, because as like a little kid, I would be running around the office. So fond memories for sure. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to get any, you know, objections from us. Obviously, all three of us are ophthalmologists and very happy with our career decisions. And I think it's wonderful. One thing that you've done that's a little bit differently than the two of us is you've pursued a business degree. So you acquired an MBA during your residency training, which is not an opportunity that a lot of people have. And tell us a little bit about what got you interested in an MBA. Were you maybe thinking about getting an MBA before medical school, or was it something that kind of just worked out? How did you decide that you wanted to pursue a business degree in addition to a medical degree and become a physician?
Yeah, I had applied for business school as an undergraduate student. I had some time between undergrad and medical school. I went to one of those combined 8-year med programs, and then I had an extra year in between because I graduated early. I didn't end up going to business school at the time. I was told from pretty much all the ones I applied to that I was too young, which I think now in hindsight was good advice. I think before one goes to business school, they should know what they want to do with the business school degree or what they want to get out of business school, which at, you know, 19 or 20 when I had applied was way too early. And I think you have to have worked for a few years and what you're ultimately going to end up doing with your life to really figure out during the time of business school how to best utilize it for your future career. So the timing with the IMBA, having, you know, intern year first, then having a full year off to kind of do sort of a full-time MBA schedule, and then finishing some of the credits along with residency. It's not ideal to do both while you're a resident, but the timing, I think, works out pretty well with you're in the meat of being in the healthcare system and you're getting some business education alongside.
It is interesting to hear that you said, you know, they told you you're a little bit too young. And like you said, in hindsight, that's exactly what you needed to hear. Maybe you felt like going through an MBA as you were in the field that you wanted to potentially use your MBA and have connections and then network in is really nice to have. But it's just a peculiar point because at the same time, that's around the age that you are kind of close to deciding that you want to be a doctor. You know, you went on this 8-year program, and that is a massive decision to make. You know, physicians listening, medical students, you know, residents, it's like the everything that entails being a physician, it's just so all encompassing. And I just think it's interesting to hear, like, you're too young to make this decision about, you know, doing MBA, but like you can make this like tremendous decision that'll affect the rest of your life forever. So that's just an interesting juxtaposition for me.
Yeah. And this is a really interesting point, I think, because we had a guest on our podcast very recently, a good friend of ours named Zach Stone, who is a pediatrician in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he is a couple of years after his training, but is now pursuing an MBA. And one of the things that he's shared with us is that the yield is just so much higher for him now that he's had some real world experience and understands a little bit better how to apply some of the principles of his MBA program. So I like that you brought that up. Share with us a little bit about how you first started to apply kind of these business inklings. My understanding is that you, as a medical student, decided that you were going to maybe pursue some real estate interests. So you've always clearly had a bug for capitalism and being a, you know, being very business savvy. So how did you really get into that? What was your first experience?
Yeah. Well, it goes back probably a while. I think I was like 18 at the time. 2012, my best friend from high school went to start a company in Palo Alto. And he was like, hey, if you're not doing anything this summer, want to intern, hang out, figure out what we're going to do, because I know you like business. And yeah, spent 3 months there in Palo Alto working at Stanford's incubator, helping him and his partner at the time set up their business. And, you know, most startups fail, which did happen with theirs as well. And then I went back to Cleveland, found out that we had a little bit of a startup scene there as well. I was going to Case Western at the time, applied for a incubator spot, and we were in one of the programs for a summer called BizDom and then Flash Darts. And it was a mobile betting company that we did this tournament for, no marketing at all. We had like 2,000 games played in a weekend. We gave away 2 half Bitcoins as a prize, which is kind of how I learned about Bitcoin. And then I bought Bitcoin back in the summer of 2012. I bought Ethereum.
Oh, wow. God.
Before it was even available to buy from the public, from a meeting that I had with this ultra wealth manager, Morgan Stanley.
I really hope you held on to that, all those cryptocurrencies, for quite a while.
I maybe sold it a little sooner than I should have, but
you can never time it perfectly. But if you waited at least a few years, I think you're doing all right.
Yeah. I did okay.
Well, very cool. So fast forward to medical school. I know that's when you decided to buy your first property. Is that right? What was that like? How did you make that leap? And kind of tell us a little bit about what that transaction was like.
With the caveat being that, like, again, you're what, like 22, 23 years old at this time. Most of us are trying to figure out how to feed ourselves, you know, and go get our shoes on and go to work and come back and get enough sleep. You're making these decisions that now, even as a 33-year-old, buying a house for me is like, that's like something, a major decision to think about. What was it like for 22-year-old you? And, you know, what did that look like for you?
Well, when I was 23, my other really good friend and I ran a crypto hedge fund. So we had 30 investors. I think at peak, we managed 15 million in assets.
Wow.
And we were able to have an opportunity to sell the business, which came from the other side of, we had a little bit of a lawsuit from an advisor, which is a whole story for another day. like getting a subpoena while you're on your OB/GYN med student rotation is not fun. There was also like a SEC subpoena that I got when I was an intern. Again, everything was fine. Everything was above board. We had like the best lawyers.
Are you just like living the Social Network like movie? Like, is that what your life has been? Because I'm getting a lot of these like incubators and like going through lawsuits while going to like, you know, prestigious programs, universities, and medical schools. Like, kind of sounds like so difficult to juggle, man.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's like what I like to do.
Yeah.
I don't think I could spend more time studying in med school and like, what do I like to do as a hobby? I don't know. I'm a pretty boring guy.
I don't think anyone would just hear this interview and think that you're a boring guy.
Could accuse you of being boring. Were you served papers in a hospital?
I was not served papers in a hospital, but I was served papers like in my apartment from a guy in like a pizza box.
That is
wild.
Oh
my gosh, that is straight out of a movie. I'm sitting here like, oh, I want to make sure I'm going to pass my UWorld questions and like I'm going to pass this like specific examination for, you know, OB/GYN. And you're out here like, SEC is served me papers.
Yeah, it's on me. That's funny. That's
wild. It has gotten harder and harder with time though to like really kind of do all the business stuff. And I'll say I was able to do all of this by having great people that I was able to work with.
Sure.
Co-founders, real estate agents, property managers, all the above. Like the people have really made it palatable. And I mean, that's what a company is, right? A company is an organization of a lot of people together that scales. You know, if you have a practice with five people, it scales to a much greater extent than if you just have two people. You know, you're able to really take advantage of all the CapEx that you have with the equipment and the pharmacy buying, and you eventually can sell them for bigger multiples. Like there's a sort of strength in numbers. And I've learned that even with just having one extra person by your side, I'm sure the effect's even greater when you have two, three, four.
Probably some element of diffusion of responsibility too, in terms of like, yes, you were getting sued, but it's this corporation, it's an LLC, whatever it is, the S corp. And so you're not just taking that on as a individual. Another point I kind of wanted to probe you on before I ask specifically a little bit more about the real estate properties. You clearly had all this really great business background. Sounds like you had some fantastic opportunities, even in university. Did you ever think like, maybe I should just focus on this business side of things instead of doing this like super long, arduous journey into medicine and, you know, have to go through medical school and really hard residency and like tough hours, like a lot of, you know, mental toll that it takes, versus not saying that it's easy to do business things. You just have the mind for it. Did you ever think, let me stick to this?
Yeah. So, I'll tell you a little story. I was a medical student and I had crushed it on the investment game for crypto that year. Crypto is ripping. And then like big problem, Mt. Gox, something got hacked. All these like essentially big crash. One of the first big crashes I experienced in this crypto space, and I lost like $9 million in a year.
Oh my God.
So medicine then becomes one of those things where you're like, wow, this is really stable. And the main reflection I got was that medicine is amazing. It's a job I enjoy doing, even if you take away the money. And I felt that more and more every day, even going through residency, walking the dark hills of Ronald Reagan at night. But having that stability and something that you'd do even if the money was taken away, like really makes me feel comfortable taking risks on the business side. Like I wouldn't change that experience for anything. It's like the adage of play a stupid game, win a stupid prize. Well, I can do that because I have something stable on the other side.
That feeds both your financial base, but also your soul, sounds like. I hope that people listening, especially because I know we have a lot of physicians, you know, medical school residency outside of training. The grass can sometimes always be a little greener. There's a lot of things and difficulties that we go through, and we can be like, why don't we just go do this like different career where we could have potentially been more successful, or whatever success measure of success is, made more money. You know, here's from somebody who's been extremely successful financially, and it really does feed the soul. So if it's the right job for you, it's not for everybody. But if it's truly what your passion is, there's probably faster ways to make more money. There absolutely are. But I think it's great to have that reaffirming from someone who's seen both sides of it and knows that, you know, you really feel at home in medicine.
Yeah. Fast way to make money, fast way to lose money. And honestly, my life never changed.
Yeah.
Been good point. Exact. Still buy this J.Crew shirt on sale. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a great answer, and you know, we're glad that you were able to cash out and sort of settle things out a little bit. But tell us, I do want to hear about how you bought your properties. I really do. It's something that interests me. I don't own any real estate. I've never had the courage to pull the trigger on anything, and you're much braver than I am, clearly. So I want to hear a little bit more about what that very first transaction was like in the real estate space.
Yeah, I think I was just sitting at lunch with my friend in Cleveland, and he wanted to go buy a rental property, and I said, that sounds like fun. I'll do that too. Let's go.
And remind us how old you were.
23.
Okay.
Yeah, this is like right after we sold the crypto fund management company. So there is like a little bit of cash sitting in the bank, and I'm like asking, what do I do with this? And yeah, my friend suggested real estate. I'd seen my parents have rental properties before, so I kind of had a little bit of an understanding of what a cap rate is. And we walked into the Keller Williams. There was a gentleman at the front desk who was my real estate agent, sold me my first bundle of four properties together from a retiring couple. Mind you, it's Cleveland, so each property was 70K or 80K. These are duplexes and triplexes, you know, Section 8 tenants, but great tenants. They generally always paid. Cleveland's pretty reasonable for landlords and tenants both, so I think it's a fair place to operate. And the cap rate's good. Like a 80K property, you're getting $1,800 a month in rent, which just on cash alone is better than what they say. I think the 1% rule is. Mm-hmm. I've never been too like diligent with the numbers of like this. I'm like, this sounds good. Like the property's 80K. It needs X to put in. This is like what the expenses should be. Water bills are always higher than you think they will be. Especially in triplexes, water bills end up being high because that's the one thing you do have to cover as a landlord if it's multi-unit. But
is this something you learned afterwards, or coming in you were like, oh, I know this because my parents?
No. I learned this like getting a water bill that was $2,000, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah. And you know, I was about to ask, I think that's a really good question that you bring up, because I kind of wonder, would you have had the courage to do this if your parents also weren't landlords? I mean, I know that, you know, it must be really nice to be able to fall back on them, ask for advice. How would they handle a difficult tenant situation, or, you know, some of the legalities, or how you draft a contract, that sort of thing. Would you have done this if your parents weren't also landlords?
I think I would have. I think I'm much more lax about things than they are. Like, whatever the lease is fine. Whatever the agreement is fine. I generally trust people in good degree, and as long as the number makes sense at the back end. Like if somebody is shafting me 5-10%, it is what it is. Like it's the cost of doing business,
just, and wow, along for the ride.
As long as I don't know it, like it's fine.
And real quick, can you define cap rate? Now everyone may know what that is, so it's a term I know, understand that you're using, you know, to describe the value of a property, but can you kind of define it for someone who may be listening that doesn't understand what that is?
Yeah, so I can probably best do it as an example.
Sure.
Honestly, it might not be right, but this is at least my understanding of it. If the property is 100K, and in most people's situations, it's going to be financed. So let's say that you have a physician loan on the property and you're paying like $2,000 a month. You're able to net $500 a month on the property after expenses. Your effective cap rate net is 20%.
I'm still going back to this point where your friend and you're at lunch, and he's like, I'm going to just like go buy this like one rental property real quick. And you're like, let me pop over. Let me just like buy a rental property too. I'm getting like, a sense of you walking in somewhere and they're just like trying to sell you a timeshare. And you're like, yeah, man, like that sounds good. The numbers look good. Like I'm going to just go for it. And it just all really happened to work out. And it sounds like this person who sold you the rental, you sight unseen, you don't know like if there's like crazy damages or something. You like listened to this guy and you kind of grew with him. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to like screw up a property that's 80K that is getting the rentals that they say they're getting. So yeah, the expenses were a little bit higher than I thought they would be, but the two things that were true were the price and the rent that came in. Beyond that, it's a little bit hard to mess up. And I had lived in Cleveland at that point for 6 years, so like, I knew the area. I knew the area was up and coming. So I figured that these would be good properties to one hold on to for the equity appreciation. But even if they didn't appreciate, which plenty of the properties I've had have not, the numbers were good enough. I was able to take advantage of the situation by buying four properties in cash from this couple. So the price was reasonable, 70, 80K. You know, 3 years later, to kind of close the loop with these properties, I had one of them burned down my intern year.
Oh my God.
And like now at this point, I'm in Los Angeles. I did get property insurance, which was very expensive at the time. And that was the one thing, you know, my mother was like, don't be stupid. Get the insurance, pay the price. It is what it is. Insurance made me whole. And then I was like, okay, doing this like rental, even with a great property manager far away, very stressful.
Was he managing from the beginning? Like, were you, while you were there, managing them yourself? Or was
managing it from the beginning? Yeah. I never walked in to collect rent. I told him like, hey, I'm happy to buy these, but I need a property manager. He's like, great, I will do it.
Yeah, I think that's the part that makes it work for me, because yeah. I know that if I were, you know, a third year medical student, there's what, 18 months or less between the time when you won't no longer be in that city, and it may be very, very difficult to manage properties from afar. But it sounds like the system was sort of greased for you from the beginning, which is kind of nice.
But that also, I think, stems from like, you still have to have somebody you trust for and sure. Who's going to be capable. And like, I'm thinking like, hey, you're in like your first year of residency, let's say, like you're a PGY2, your first year of ophthalmology. And you are, you know, you're working some long hours, you're on call, you're just finished like a harbor day where you've worked from like 7 a.m. and you're leaving at like 6, okay? You're sweeping the ED. There's three patients that need to be seen. Just wait, one more popped up. There's four. Level one trauma came in, might have a ruptured globe. And then you are also balancing like, hey, just by the way, like your property burned down real quick. So let's just like kind of address those little things. And then keep in mind that you still need to do some opto questions. So you're prepared for, you know, the equivalent of the oral boards, the boards for ophthalmology. So how do you balance all of this? Like, how do you make it work?
Yeah, some weeks are better than others. You know, I operate really well, like the 80 to 90% of full capacity, but there's plenty of weeks where it hits the 100%. You know, residency, I'm now realizing, is probably going to be a little bit easier than when I'm in attending, because we have periods of times where you're on elective and you get vacation because of ACGME rules. And like, in the real world, it's eat what you kill. The opportunity cost is like a week of collections. When you're seeing 40 patients a day, like it gets harder and harder. And then I'll have a wife and I'll have family and
kids. There's no such thing as vacation. And I'm telling you, with a one-year-old, like that, your time is very quickly eaten up.
Yeah. Well, I'll also just chime in real quickly. Don't just assume that the moment you become an attending that there's 40 patients a day ready to see you. It's not always the case. And that can be a little bit jarring too. You might think that residency is easier than being an attending, and it is, but not necessarily for the reasons that you describe. I think it can be a little bit different. Personally, just not feeling as needed early on. Now, depending on where you know, the job that you start, it very well may be that you're just walking into a system that is greased and has a lot of patients that need to be seen. But more often than not, you're building your practice from the ground up. Even if you're joining an existing practice, you still have to establish yourself a little bit. And I've personally just found that residency was a lot easier than being an attending, not necessarily because the demand is so high, but because I am just not as busy as I'd like to be yet. But I think that's very normal.
And I think within, especially within private practice, that's very much the case. That doesn't mean that you have 40 hours a week that you're not working. Like, you're trying to find ways to be, get yourself busy. Right. But it is an interesting note that Gio points. It's like you go from the grandiosity of like being a senior resident where like you're top of the food chain in a sense, you're busy surgically, like you're needed, you have a lot of things to balance in terms of responsibilities, to realizing you're just another little fish in a pond, in a big, big pond. And you have to make your name.
It's like a startup, or it's like starting a business. It's, you're not necessarily in demand the moment that you start your business or start your startup. And it's a little different, but,
I mean, if I think if anyone's equipped to probably handle some of those issues, I bet you, you are just so easygoing. You describe all these situations that sound so stressful to me, to have to balance all this. And yet you clearly have had a lot of success. When you talk, you just speak so calmly. I think that's just your general demeanor. So I just commend you on, you know, having the kind of brain for this and the kind of demeanor and personality to, you know, make it work. So it's impressive.
Yeah, I certainly couldn't do it. So have you sold any of your houses, or what are you holding on to them? Or what's the status of those first couple of properties that you bought in Cleveland?
Yeah, after that first one burned down, I then went ahead and said, you know, this is stressful. You know, that was a bad week. And I, you know, was filling out paper with insurance and dealing with like, what do I do now? Are these tenants going to sue me? Do I have adequate protection? You know, the stakes aren't that high, right? I'm a resident. It's not like somebody can really go after like my medical practice or my medical license. Maybe they could have, I don't know, ignorance is bliss. But I then went and sold the properties. I offloaded them individually. I made a pretty good profit on the ones that, you know, still had four walls and a roof.
That were standing.
I was made whole by insurance on the one that did burn down. And then there was a period of like a year with no real estate. And in that time, I found a little way to do some real estate investment without actually having to do the liability part of it. I did a little bit of hard money lending, which for people that might not be familiar, a hard money loan is essentially a loan between private entities that's backed by either a balance sheet from the company or the cash flow or real estate assets, in order to provide somebody with quick cash for a pretty generous interest rate, usually anywhere between 10 to sometimes even 16%. So you don't have to do any work. You know, you have an agreement with them. Hey, I will give you X number of dollars. Let's call it $100,000 for 1 year for you to buy, rehab, and sell this property. So I'm basically the bank for you because you're not able to get traditional lending. And in exchange, you know, if you were able to get traditional lending, the bank would take 2 months. You know, Andres, you've gone through the mortgage process. It sounds like it's like they kind of dig through every single crack and crevice in your body.
Do they also offer lower rates than probably what you would offer as a hard
money? Yeah. A commercial rate from a bank is probably 8%. Mm-hmm. But even like an SBA loan, which we tried to get for a business that I invested with my friend, which is a restaurant, which is a whole nother story for another day. Tough business. not recommended. But an SBA loan from the government is around 12%.
Wow.
It's like a prime rate plus 3.5% plus like another little bit added on. So it's usually between, I think it was like most recently 11.5%.
That's really, I would think that sounds really high. So what are you offering as a hard money lender? Like, what's the kind of rate that you offer? Maybe that's variable, but
yeah, 14%.
That sounds great. That's a better return than probably even some really good index funds if you were out there.
Yeah.
Is it really hard to access, you know, the ability to become a hard money lender? Does it need to like high amounts of like cash that you like are clearly lending here? Or how do you get into this?
The two things that are difficult with it is you need to have cash available when people need a loan, and you don't exactly know when you're going to get the money back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they pay back on time. I mean, knock on wood, like, I've never had somebody not pay back a loan, and I've done 8 of them at this point. But I either have only done it with two people. One is with my real estate agent, who's my property manager, who's now my business partner, who I trust, who now I flip everything with my real estate agent and I give him 50-50. Like, I split everything down the middle. I put up the money for the property. He puts up some money for the rehab. Sometimes I put a little more, sometimes he puts a little more. And we have a very good understanding where we sell the property and we split it 50-50, which I think my advisor told me this is pretty generous for you to do. And I said, yeah, but then like, he's not going to call anybody else. He's just going to call me.
Well, that seems like you clearly have the right team around you, which that part of me thinks you've walked through life, like drinking that little juice that Harry Potter drinks and you're just like lucky for, you know, your life. But I think it sounds like some of these, this ability to have that success is because you've accepted that you're not going to get as much return on some of these investments, knowing that you're working with the right people and they're going to take care of you. So that's a really interesting way to kind of approach things, is to like, know it's the cost of doing business. Maybe you won't get as much as you could have, but you're working with the people that are going to make sure that they take care of you because of it.
Totally. And there's, no, I'm giving all good examples, but there's examples where I've not done so well. I bought another duplex in Cleveland, put 120K into it, thinking I would live there, which is probably why I spent a little more. Project took a year and a half. And then, I think I maybe like ended up losing probably a little bit on that property. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you kind of have to play the game and accept that you won't always win. And if you are not comfortable with that, then
that's like any investment, though. It's like you have to understand what amount of risk there is. Like, clearly this hard money lending, you have more potential to get than like a really well-performing index fund in any given year. But there's going to be more risk associated, and that you just have to be willing to tolerate those risks. Just like any financial decision you make, you know, going to medical school is a financial risk that you're taking. So you have to kind of approach those. And it seems like you have the mind to kind of think about these things like in a very transactional way, which is not to break that down in a negative way. It's just like, that's really useful. So a question I had for you is like, man, you've told us all of these things that you've learned. You've been incubators, you know about, you know, real estate, you know that you're not going to be successful in maybe restaurants. So again, when you got to like thinking about doing an MBA, at this point, you're very business savvy. Like, what did you want to take from it? Like, what is it, just the connections? Like, was there something specific you want to work towards? What was the reasoning there?
Yeah, I thought, you know, every time in life where I've had a little bit of a break has been very valuable for me, because when I have that time, I don't sit very well with time off. I think of something to do. I have an idea. Whenever I have an idea in life, I'm like, great, let's test it. What's the cost? Money? Sure. I mean, people go to medical school and they forget that that's a $250,000 investment plus 4 years of your life. They go to business school. That's a $120,000 investment in 2 years of your life. Well, you can take $120,000 and invest it in a property, and you're probably not going to lose 120K. Even worst case, you lose half of it. You learn a lot for that 60K.
Yeah, it's true. But the loan structure is very different for a loan to buy a house and then, you know, a loan to go to graduate school or medical school or what have you. So it is a little bit of a different, you know, degree of short-term risk, I think. But I think that sounds really neat. You know, one thing that kind of intrigues me is your perspective on the, you know, maybe the housing market over the next 12 to 18 months. Do you have, as a homeowner, do you have any concerns or even a little bit of optimism for those of us who might either be homeowners or might be interested in buying a house in the next couple of, maybe next year, maybe?
I can briefly go over, like, because we bought our house 6 months ago. So we started looking. I basically have been looking since I moved to LA, like my intern year. And I looked at condos in like Inglewood, and then I looked at two bedrooms in Westwood. And then I looked at, after meeting my partner and, you know, getting engaged, we looked at buying a condo. And then we were like, you know, a single family house west of the 405 in LA is always going to be worth gold in my mind. And it's a huge sum. The mortgage is ridiculous, but I just view it as a large savings account. It's like forced discipline, right? If you have to put money away for this mortgage, you get tax benefits. You know, you can write off up to 750K's principal's worth of interest from your taxes, $10,000 from property tax. So there is a benefit to home ownership.
But also an opportunity cost, right? Because that's probably not necessarily a return that you wouldn't see better in, yeah, maybe an index fund that performs well.
Absolutely. I think diversification is what I learned most from the whole $9 million snafu. That you can't put all of your eggs in one basket, and you do get a utility being able to live in the house, have a place to call home that somebody can't displace you from. So there is something nice about the home ownership too. I encourage it for everybody. I haven't met that many people that have been too upside down buying a house, as long as you think you'll be able to live there for a few years. I think it's hard to time the market. I think if you wait for interest rates to come down, which they inevitably will, then a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines waiting to buy.
And it's a bidding war.
Yeah, when we were looking, it was a bidding war, and interest rates were, I think, 8-something at the time, 8% plus. Oh, and
that's awful.
This property we walked into sat for a month because it was a little too high and the interest rate was high. And I told the agent, hey, you can be our agent, double in the deal. Great. You get commission from us, you get commission from them. And whenever they decide to sell the property, just call me first. Like, let's do this off market. I don't want to do this whole bidding war. And she called me and we were able to buy it off market. So it kind of worked out.
Wow.
Wow. You're like BlackRock or Vanguard. Just buying houses off without a listing. That's pretty cool. That's pretty neat.
But that is one approach that can have. I mean, that's a very valid approach. Very smart. Not most people think to do that.
Just go knock on doors. If you want to go live in a neighborhood, just go knock on the door and like show them a picture of your 1-year-old and say like, hey, if you want to sell, like, I'm not some schmuck from BlackRock.
I mean, that's like when at the height of the housing, when the rates were like 3%, 2.something%, and people don't even know, like, have these bidding wars, they start accepting, these letters of like interest, and like people tell their story and like, my family is going to live in your house and here's what we look like and here's like our values. And they sometimes make decisions based on that when their bidding wars just get out of hand. And so you're kind of prematurely doing that. So you're not waiting till the bidding war happens, but saying, hey, I'm expressing my interest if you want to leave, and kind of gives you first dibs. So I think that's actually pretty brilliant to do. You have to have the time, of course. You're there for residency. You know you want to stay there potentially. Then it's like you have to wait out till that becomes available. And if you kind of do that with a couple of different places, then you kind of, not put all your eggs in one basket necessarily.
Yeah, it was just like looking to find something that would be a good fit. And not being too married, like, this property is amazing, I have to get it at whatever cost. I tried to be as unemotional as you can be, buying your, the home that you plan to live in for 10 years, let's say, at least. But yeah, looking back at it, I'm glad we did it. They do, the real estate agents have all their lines. Like, you marry the house and you date the rate. So the rate, you can always refinance it later. And I think ultimately what I've realized is the dollar amount that you actually buy the house for is probably the most important thing. So if there's an opportunity to take advantage of that, like people say, in COVID, the houses were cheaper and it was a 3% rate, but also like the market had taken a 30% dump that year. So people were buying with much less assets than they have today.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know what the Dow was at the time. It was like probably 40% of what it is now. So yeah, people got a great rate.
That's again where you hedge your bets. You buy a house, you put more money in the market, and then watch them both go up and then prosper, right? You just time the market perfectly if you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to do, right? Everything is so expensive now. Like, ophthalmology isn't what it used to be. Like $500 a cataract for Medicare versus $3,000.
And you're living in LA. Like that's even less so, in a very high cost of living area. So here's a question that I have for you. We've learned a lot about fascinating, story of your life, how you got into medicine, what you've done, multiple side projects, how you've diversified, found your soul in medicine. I want to ask, what kind of general advice, physicians, we do so much education. We start our first jobs when we're in our 30s, because we're in training for so long. But I wouldn't say we're the most financial literate bunch. And so if you had some general tips to give, med students, residents, people thinking about medicine, just general physicians that are in practice now and especially early career, what kind of advice would you give about, you know, good steps, good financial habits, that kind of good stuff?
Try and make more money. it's like a joke, but if there's one thing that makes life easier, I think it's always easier to, and something sometimes overlooked, like you should try and optimize how much money you can earn, because that can make your life more peaceful than saying like, hey, don't buy your daily latte. It's like, okay, just make a little bit more money, buy your latte, be happy.
Are you saying make more money by negotiating with your like contract when we're choosing a residency that's going to pay you more relative to the cost of living? Or are you saying
find a side hustle? Side
gigs? Yeah. What's the...
Yeah. I mean, this is a tough question. It's like life's hard. Everything's expensive. I'm like not really in a position to say like do what I did, because I got incredibly lucky and I've taken these wild risks that are not really replicable. Like I basically took 90% of the money that I had made in my life and bought crypto. Like life-changing serendipitous event. I don't know why I did it. I think I was like just having a bad day, lost money with one investment, just shoved it all into something else risky, and like I got lucky.
Well, I'm going to keep waiting for my bad day. But let's phrase it this way. Let's say you just finished residency. You're used to, and obviously this is less applicable to you, but you just finished residency. You know, you're doing okay in terms of like, you're making enough money. You're not making an attending level, but you just got your first attending paycheck. I think the impetus, and it depends on the person. Some people are more fiscally conservative. Some people will just, want to say, I finally made it. I'm going to spend it. But how do you kind of structure some of this, like, you know, your initial paychecks, and how do you think about how you're going to spend? What general advice would you say to that person just finishing residency and starting an attendingship and first years of being an attending?
I would say while you're a resident, put money away for retirement, because the compounding is tremendous. I have a friend that's an EM resident in LA from Harvard that put 120K away as a resident. Effective compounding, and they don't have some like very good investment plan through the LA County plan. And yeah, you make a little bit of sacrifice here and there, but you can do it as a resident, because most people, they work conventional jobs, could start planning for retirement at 22. Medicine, you might have taken some time off. You might not have saved very much as a resident. For your time as an attending, put as much as you can away for retirement.
And especially at the early onset, right? Like the very beginning, that's when the compounding is going
to
matter the most.
Yeah, you have to start early. There's no doubt that, you know, in medicine, our lives start later than everyone else, right? And if you wait a little too long, starting in your 30s may very well just add too much stress.
It'll work out, but I think you're right. The earlier, the probably the better. And do you have a specific breakdown of like where you would park that in terms of a savings? Some people just put in like, here, monitor for this, me. Like some people get financial advisors, which I think can be crazy, because sometimes they don't perform and they can charge you a good amount. And so I personally like the three fund portfolio. And that's like something that if I don't choose to day trade, they generally perform pretty well. But like, do you have any advice in terms of what you would put anything into if you were gonna, you know, put something into retirement now to compound?
Yeah, I mean, just buy like your standard index fund, your VOO, three fund portfolio, one fund portfolio. They're all the same in my mind. I mean, I do have a financial advisor.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a hot take.
You have different finances than probably most. What I would say, if somebody's trying to sell you whole life insurance and, you know, those kind of situations where, you know, you see and you're not really coming out on top, it's a little different than having all these different assets that you have and then choosing, you know, tax implications and how to maneuver things to, you know, not have as much taken from you and to grow to the whatever growth you want to have, right?
Right. Don't get a financial advisor unless it's like somebody that has some skin in the game with you personally.
Fiduciary obligation.
Fiduciary doesn't mean anything. No. It's all nonsense. I mean, like somebody that really will have your back because like they're your buddy's buddy and they can't screw you over.
Yeah, it's hard to find.
Like I have had a whole life insurance policy before. And, you know, I had a conversation with him, like, hey, man, what is this crap you sold me? And, like, you know, we got past it and I do trust him. And, but my situation's a little different and he kind of helps me keep everything sort of track of because I only can do so much at the time I have.
Yeah. And we probably don't want to get in the business of trying to give, you know, tax advice or investing advice per se. But I do think your point is well taken that you need to start early. It needs to be safe. And you really need to be able to invest in a manner as a resident so that you don't have to be so actively involved. You can focus more on your career and learning how to be a physician and sort of park your money and think about it a little bit later, maybe when you have more flexibility. One thing I think maybe a good way to conclude this interview would be to ask a little bit about what's on the horizon for you. You know, obviously you're in your senior year of residency, you're going to be looking for your first job, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about what sort of entrepreneurial investments are in the forecast for the next couple of months or maybe in the next year. What are you looking forward to doing soon enough?
Yeah, well, there's always a house to buy and flip. There's always a loan to be written to somebody. But the main, you know, the big investment will be like the long-term career that starts in a year from now. That's where I've been, you know, talking to you guys offline, getting advice of what do I do, right? I've never done any of these things in my life alone. And you guys are going to be part of this journey of like, what do I do as an ophthalmologist? You know, I have some sort of understanding of like how the business stuff works with like, I think I want 1099 income.
Sure.
I have a fiance who gets corporate benefits that I can leech off of a little bit. So I'm in a fortunate situation there.
I would say we're, of course, super happy to be a resource. We by no means have all the answers figured out, but you certainly do learn a couple things along the way, even in the first 1, 2, 3 years. And this is why we're happy to have this podcast. We're learning from other people like you. There's things we don't know. There's things you know. There's things you don't know and things you don't know you don't know. You've certainly taught us a lot today. I look forward to hearing from other guests too and sharing our own experiences to see how we can kind of help each other grow in our early careers in medicine.
Yeah, we're all just paying it forward, right? Yeah. So we got advice from people and, you know, we're trying to share what little we know, but also learn from our peers too. And so we definitely appreciate you coming on and sharing so much insight about things that we know absolutely nothing about. So we're really looking forward to catching up with you soon enough offline.
Yeah, and we wish you all the best with looking for job prospects. Again, I would say there's a lot of things behind the scenes and things that you won't be used to in terms of coming from a position in residency where you were kind of sought out and having to make your own name. But we're all doing this together. And thank you so much again for being with us today. Sagar, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure's all mine. Thanks, guys.